Nicholson, Reel 15.
24 days that battle for Way lasted. And when the army withdrew, they went in and discovered that that during those 24 days, the North Vietnamese, for reasons which I never understood, actually slaughtered as many people as they could within the city walls, Vietnamese themselves. Upwards of 3,000 slaughtered, clubbed to death, stabbed to death, shot to death, buried in shallow graves. And the Americans lost over 1,000 men themselves. And years later, if I can just jump ahead, I met this blind North Vietnamese who told me about his part in that battle. And his part appeared in a movie, a Hollywood movie about the Battle of Hue. I think it was called the something Metal Jacket. And he said he was a sniper, and he saw an American Marine come through a hole in the wall to advance. He sighted, and he shot him. And as the man lay there dead, another Marine came out to drag the body back. The Marines have this a regimental rule, whatever you like to call it, tradition, that you never leave your wounded on the battlefield. And so they sent another Marine in to pull back this dead body. And as this man came out through the same hole, the sniper said he shot him. 7 times Marines came through the hole in the wall to retrieve their dead, and 7 times this man shot each of them. He said, I couldn't understand it. They knew I was there. They knew that every time they came through the wall I would kill them, and yet they still kept coming. He said they were very brave men. He said, but they were very stupid men. I'll always remember that. And I asked him how he was blinded. He said that a few days after that he was blinded by an American hand grenade. When the dead were counted, eventually, as I said, it was upwards of, I think, 3,000, 4,000 Americans died in that way offensive. And the communists, altogether during that whole Tet Offensive, lost 60,000. And as I said, it took much longer to count the civilian dead because they were buried beneath the rubble, they were buried in shallow graves, were actually buried on just in sewers and things. Can we just stop there a second, because I think that...
It's interesting you saying, Michael, about the enormous help you were given by the American authorities, mm-hmm. you know, getting helicopters mm-hmm. and going to the battle scenes. Mm-hmm. Were there many journalists at this time, before the Americans withdrew?
Yes. Oh, yes.
And would they have been of all nationalities?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I could tell you about Michel Laurent, but that was in the last few days. That was a very sad story. Well, we can talk about it if you like. Are you on?
Yes, this is...
I mean, Vietnam, I mean, there'll never be another war like Vietnam, inasmuch as there'll never be another war that allowed journalists so much freedom to report it. Every country, every government, every military in the world learnt from Vietnam that if you give journalists, especially cameramen, free access to what you're doing, there'll be a greater enemy than the enemy that you're fighting. It is suicidal to allow journalists total freedom. Not because they're going to give away our enemy secrets to the enemy. They don't know secrets to give away. But what they will do is report, not often fairly, and not often without prejudice, what they see, and that can be, as you know, wholly detrimental to the military operation. Every afternoon, 4 o'clock, I think it was, in the press information office in Tudo in Saigon, some American ass would stand up, some young lieutenant, probably only a few months out of the US. We set up and give you the latest casualty figures. And he'd tell you how many thousands of communists had died that day and how amazingly few Americans. And it came, it was such a fuss, such a lie, told, you know, with this honest face of a 20-year-old, just repeating all the myths that his generals were handing him down, that eventually we called it the 4 o'clock follies. And it became a circus, and nobody treated it with any seriousness. The Americans went to great lengths to hide the body bags. The body bags are the plastic, rubber plastic bags that you put the dead body in to send home. And the casualty figures, like the body bags, were well hidden by the Americans. I think if the American public had been aware of American casualties earlier on in the war would have been concluded much earlier. But like all military, the American military is good at lying. That includes all militaries, including our own. I think probably we're more better at it, more prolific. Probably we invented it. But every government from then on realized that to allow the press access, uncontrolled access, to what is going on is the quickest way to lose your war. And Maggie Thatcher learned that in the Falklands. The Israelis eventually learned that in the Middle East. And every government since, including the Americans, who now are extremely strict about what they allow the press to see and say. So that was the last free war for the communicator.
Would there have been a difference, you know, you being British and this not being a British war? Do you think you reported it differently from, say, the Americans, or you had more access, perhaps?
No, there was no restriction. I think, obviously, Americans, journalists who were well known to Americans, American TV reporters, for example, well known, were probably given a better treatment. Of course, you expect that. I mean, they're well-known faces at home, and the Americans are more concerned with what people thought at home than anywhere else. And so you'd expect the American reporter to be given greater freedom, more access, more inside information than the rest of us. That would be the same with any national, working for any national army. No complaints. No, there was a great deal of freedom, and if you wanted to go places, you went there. And there was no censorship. None at all.
But was there less bias, the fact that it wasn't your side fighting, would you say?
I think we were just as cryptic, just as cynical, just as inventive as anybody. I went out to Vietnam, I have to say honestly, with an open mind. I was one of those at the time who believed in the domino theory, that if Vietnam fell, which is the whole purpose, the whole credo of the Americans in the first place in going to Vietnam, was to stop the rest of Asia going communist. You know, the domino theory was that if Vietnam went, then Cambodia would go, then Thailand would go, then Laos would go. And, of course, that's how it happened, except with the exception of Thailand. But I went there believing that, you know, the communists should be beaten. And I think probably the majority of journalists went out at the time in the late 60s with the impression that the Americans were going to win and they were there for the right reason. It's only later that we realised that the CIA had played double crosses all the way along, and that the Americans were losing the war as early as 66, 67. Had we known it then, of course, we'd had a different attitude. But it's only, I think, my attitude changed from what I saw, which is, I think, the way a journalist should work. Had I gone there, you know, despising the American involvement and had seen that they were doing the right thing, I hope I would have changed my mind in that direction. But like almost every journalist, without exception, including famous American journalists like Walter Cronkite, who said as early as 68 that the Americans were losing the war. No, I think most journalists, including the right-wingers, the real right-wingers, the real Republicans, very quickly saw from their own eyes that the war was not winnable and that the Americans were wrong to be there.
Yes, that early tank battle, you seem to have learnt a lot, the noise they were making and the way they, the suicidal attempts by the guerrillas. It must be a very difficult war, that sort of guerrilla war.
You can't fight as the Russians found in Afghanistan, as the Americans were quick to realise in their latest involvement in Afghanistan. You can't fight guerrillas with tanks. The Americans managed to succeed using B-52s and 57s in Afghanistan, but they couldn't use them that effectively in Vietnam. You know, they had a, again, it shows the American psyche that one of the reasons they couldn't disrupt the Ho Chi Minh Trail, one of the reasons they couldn't destroy the Vietnamese guerrillas moving across country was because so much of Vietnam is wooded. It's a huge forest, huge tropical forest, wonderful, wonderful forests, including the Michelin rubber plantations, of course. So the Americans decided that one way to sort them out would be to destroy the forests. If men are hiding in forests, destroy the forests. And so they had a thing called Agent Orange, which was a defoliant, killed the trees, of course, not just the leaves, which they sprayed from C-130s. And these C-130s would just patrol up and down these huge thousands of acres of wonderful, wonderful forests, destroying them. It did nothing. It did nothing except destroy the forest. It didn't destroy the Viet Cong. There was another wonderful thing called, I think it was called the People Eater, Purple People Eater was the nickname. And at night, of course, the Viet Cong tended to move at night. So the Americans devised this machine, which was put into a helicopter, in which they'd fly over an area where there was thought to be Viet Cong, and it picked up the amount of ammonia in the air. Detected. So, you know, if you have a large group of people, they give off body odor, give off ammonia, which this machine was sensitive enough to detect. So it would fly over and say, "Right, you know, there's an awful lot of people down there, bomb it." Now, that could be a village, you see, could be anything. But that is the way they worked. They would have helicopters working for a thing called PsychOps, which is psychological operations. And these helicopters would have loudspeakers, a bit like Apocalypse Now, playing Wagner. And they would get actors and actresses in Saigon to give out messages, even to act out tiny plays in which they were the ghosts of the departed spirits of the people on the ground, telling them that they shouldn't fight, saying that the Americans were friends, saying the communists would eat their babies and all that. And they would fly over at night, broadcasting this to the villagers below. Eerie, creepy stuff. Psychological operations. Of course, it never worked. So what are we going to next?
How about the South Vietnamese army? You know, were you getting an impression of the South Vietnamese and how they were fighting?
Well, yeah, we're moving towards the last days, aren't we? So maybe this would be the time to bring it in. In 73, I forget the date now, 73, a peace was brokered. 72, 73, a peace was brokered in Paris between Kissinger, Henry Kissinger, Le Duc Tho, the North Vietnamese mediator, representative, in which the war would end, the Americans would leave, and there would be democratic elections in the South. I covered those Paris talks. I was there for 6 weeks, and we all realized that this wasn't a peace. I remember doing a piece to camera, a stand-upper for television, in which my report ended. I didn't say it was my opinion, though it was. The observers, inverted commas, are already saying this is not a peace, but simply a piece of paper to get the Americans out without any further embarrassment. And that's what it was, of course. We filmed the Americans leaving, you know, great lorry convoys of people going, thumbs up signs, the stars and stripes, bugles and brass bands. I went to the Philippines, to Subic Bay, to see the first of the American prisoners of war coming out of Hanoi, out of the Hanoi Hilton. All terribly emotional, you know, all the stuff the Americans love. Stars and Stripes, Land of Life, whatever it is they play. Each of them getting off the plane looking mangy, half dead. But in there, they've been put into proper uniforms on the flight, saluting. I remember one man who'd been in the Hilton, the prison camp called the Hanoi Hilton for some years, very emaciated, hardly able to walk. And he went to the microphone, gave a salute and said, "I could not have endured these years had it not been for my faith in Jesus and the president of the United States." You know, can you believe it? Because the president of the United States at the time was President Nixon, who had to resign in certain shameful circumstances. But that was the atmosphere then. The Americans were out. And there was going to be democratic elections. Of course, it was nonsense. I did a piece to camera on the day of the ceasefire, sitting in a trench, looking at my watch, saying, "It's now 10, 12, 10, 9 seconds to the end of this war. Zero." And we heard straight away shelling. The war wasn't over. But of course it was over for the Americans. They were out of it. And it was now left to the poor South Vietnamese to take over. Now they were a well-equipped army. The Americans left most of their armor behind. They had trained the South Vietnamese. They were a very plucky, very well-disciplined army. But of course, they were no match for the might of the North. And they knew they were losing. I mean, an army that knows it's already fighting a rearguard action is not an army that knows it has a chance. I mean, they were dispirited. A lot of their generals had already opted and taken gold and their wives to America, to California. But what remained did put up a fight. The war changed for us, of course. As I said, in the early days, you just ring up the PIO, the press information officer, and say, "Right, I want to go to Koo Chi." Next morning, you're in Koo Chi. That night, you were back again. It wasn't like that anymore. The Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese Army, ARVIN, as it was abbreviated, ARVIN, used the helicopters for themselves. So we had to hire taxis, believe it or not. We had to just hire a car, get in it in the morning in Saigon, and go look for war. Now the only way, because you were getting no help from the South Vietnamese, they didn't want to know about the Western press anymore. They knew what the Western press was going to do to them, you know, kill them. It was one way or the other. So they went to look for war. The only way you could find a war was to look to the sky. If you saw smoke rising, you knew there was action. If you saw aircraft in the sky, you knew there was action. So you'd simply steer towards it. You'd get out your map. You had a local driver, of course, and a local interpreter. And you would steer towards it and hoped you would find it. I remember we'd go Highway 1. Oh, it's the road to An Loc. Amazing, I can still remember all these, even referring to books and everything, I can still remember these names. It's imprinted, An Loc, Highway 1, the main highway north. And I had my American cameraman with me, Marvin Farkas, who was a great hairy giant of a man. used to call him Bison. Absolutely gung-ho. I was pretty gung-ho, as always have been, but he was even more gunny. He'd go and pick up a mine and wonder if it was ever going to go off. And we were driving along, and along Highway 1, and he used to play the ukulele. I still remember a few of his songs. And when he ran out of songs, he used to recite every kind of Groucho Marx film that had ever been made. He knew every Groucho Marx line. And then we were driving along, and suddenly I see an explosion about 150 yards up on our right. Ooh, you say, better be careful. Then there's another explosion about 100 yards up on our right. And pretty soon after, there's another explosion, only about 50 yards away. So you see, right off, and the roads in Vietnam are built up because of the flooding. They're about 6 feet higher than the rest of the land, like a railway track embankment, you know. So we stopped the car, and I hair down into the ditch. Marvin says, I've left my ukulele. He goes back to get it, and I grab him from behind his belt, his trousers. I grab him, and I pull him back into the ditch. And at that very moment, the car blows up. Direct hit, recoilless rifle, big shell. And we thought these were just explosions, were kind of indiscriminate mortars. But in fact, they'd actually been firing at us and were getting their range. And so the car's on fire. And we suddenly look up and we can see ahead of us, well, I don't know, 50, 60 yards ahead, a small group of Arvin, South Vietnamese guys. And there's a bald-headed American. The Americans left a few, what they called, advisors behind. And this American major was up there. It looked like Telles of Alice. And we crawled up and he said, hey, thanks, guys. Now we know where the bastards are. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, we've been trying to locate some Viet Cong battery, and we didn't know where they were. Well, we now know where they are because we could see them firing at you. Thanks. He said, thank you. So he calls in an airstrike, and then we film the airstrike, and these aircraft come in, and they bomb the smithereens out of this hidden Viet Cong encampment. So then we go over later when it's all over, and we film the bodies of the men who only a half an hour before had been trying to kill us. It was most unusual. So that's how you went to... I'll talk about the villages a bit later, because one of the more dramatic things happened to me in a village in Cambodia, when again it was other people's lives who saved mine. What else? So we go on to last days now. We went up and down the country covering the war with the army, but little by little the South Vietnamese army was retreating south. Now, we didn't think it was going to be as quick as it was. Nobody did. I was sent out to Vietnam on New Year's Eve in 75 for the last time. And so I went through January, February, March, watching the collapse of Vietnam. I was also in Cambodia at the time. We'll come to that later. First week of April, it suddenly announced that the South Vietnamese government, as such it was surrendering the northern provinces to the communists. They couldn't defend them any longer. The northern provinces, Wei, Quang Tri, that area, near to what we called the DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone. They were simply relinquishing them. They couldn't defend them any longer. And everything was moving south. So we flew up there to film the evacuation of the army and of the people. And I suppose those last few weeks of April were the most dramatic of the entire war. Not only were we seeing an army in retreat, in absolute pandemonium chaos, we saw the last of the Americans leaving their various, what they called consulates, but they were kind of quasi-CIA posts, military post-CIA posts. But we also saw which was probably the most dramatic and, in picture terms, the most horrifying and sad, was the evacuation of an entire population. They lived in total fear of the North Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese. I suppose, engulfed as they were over the years with American and South Vietnamese propaganda, that, you know, the North Vietnamese were going to eat the babies and rape the women and, you know, destroy everything in their path. Total chaos and fear. People just evacuating south. We got on the last plane out of Hue with the American, a very famous picture of the American pilot punching Vietnamese in the face who were trying to scramble aboard. As the plane took off, and some of the helicopters took off, people were hanging onto the tires, the undercarriage. And as the undercarriage went up, of course, these people were either squashed to smithereens or they just fell off to their deaths. That's how desperate they were. And we followed the evacuation all the way south. We can just switch off there, because I'd like to.